Welcome to the second program of WERU's special presentation of selections from the 30th annual Camden Conference, held in February of 2017 in Camden, Maine. I'm Jim Campbell. The theme of the 2017 Camden Conference was Refugees and Global Migration, Humanity's Crisis. As we mentioned in the first program in this series, it's important to note that under international law and international agreements, there are different categories of people who are seeking new places to live. These are important distinctions that often get overlooked. Forcibly displaced people may be forced to move from their homes to other locations within the borders of their own countries. These people are referred to as internally displaced people, or IDPs. Although the problem may be of enormous proportions, these people are not considered refugees, though they often turn into refugees later if their countries cannot provide necessary support for them to sustain life. Refugees are people who cross international borders looking for a safe place to live. 193 countries of the world, including the United States, have committed to support refugees who would face the danger of death or persecution were they to return to the countries that they had left. On today's program, we'll hear first from Cass Mudde, an associate professor of public and international affairs at the University of Georgia and a researcher at the Center for Research on Extremism at the University of Oslo in Norway. Later in the program, we'll hear a presentation by Timothy J. Kane, the J.P. Conte Fellow in Immigration Studies at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Both speakers use slides in their presentations, but both explain the content of the slides in their remarks. We begin with Cass Mudde's presentation entitled, Has the Refugee Crisis Created a Perfect Storm for the Far Right? Here is Cass Mudde.
Well, thank you very much. I apologize for my voice. I'm fighting a cold, which I won't blame on Maine. I actually will blame it on Georgia. February is the time that we actually have a difference in temperature. So what I'm going to focus on today is to make the connection between the refugee crisis and the rise of the radical right. And before I do that, I will first, talk a little bit about the history, because here in the U.S., with the rise of Trump, the media have discovered the topic of the radical right and think that it all started here, but it didn't. And actually, even here, it didn't start with Trump. Post-war Europe was very much defined by the Second World War and by the Holocaust. And so after the Second World War, every initiative, pretty much for decades, was set up with in mind, never forget, never again. And pretty much the whole moral order was around the evil was fascism. And as a consequence, depending on the country, from countries like Germany and the Netherlands, where even the mildest form of nationalism was perceived as just the first step to Auschwitz, to countries like Italy, where they made a convenient distinction between Italian fascism and German national socialism. But overall, the idea was this should never happen again. And logically, radical right parties, particularly fascist parties, had a hard time getting back in shape. And so we had a small wave in the first 10 years after the war of so-called post-fascism, which was really just some old hands of the fascist parties of the Second World War, only really in Italy and Germany. And then in the 1950s, 60s, we had a second wave of right-wing populism, which was a very diverse group from farmers, primarily in the Netherlands and France, to anti-tax, anti-welfare kind of populist parties in Scandinavia. Again, very weak, not much success. They really only started in the 1980s with what is called the third wave of the radical right. Now, this third wave was linked to mass immigration and to political resentment. just some dates and numbers so that you understand that the radical right in Europe predates not just the refugee crisis, it predates the Great Recession as well. It's not just a function of crisis. It's more structural. So the Front National in France won 14.9% of the vote in 1997. Now, just in case you don't know that, most European countries have proportional representation, which means that a good score is something like 25%. Like, often the biggest party in a country is about one-third of the vote. So if you have about 15% of the vote, you will be the third biggest party. You will matter, generally. The FPÖ, the Austrian Freedom Party, won 27% of the vote in 1999, actually entered the government in 2000. The Swiss People's Party won 26.6% of the vote, has actually been the biggest party in Switzerland for many years now. Overall, in Western Europe, radical right parties gained about 1.7% in the 1980s to about 4.8% in the 1990s and about 5.9% in the first decade of this century. Today, it would probably be around 10-12%. Now, that doesn't sound that much, but it's all very uneven. And so there are roughly a third of countries where there is no radical right to speak of. And then there are certain countries where the radical right will be the biggest party, will get a third of the vote or even more. The refugee crisis has created a perfect storm for the radical right. The populist radical right combines three different features: nativism, authoritarianism, and populism. Nativism is the idea that a state, a political unit, should be congruent with a nation, a cultural unit. What it by and large argues is that every nation should have its own state, every state should have its own nation, should be monocultural. Nativism also perceives anything that is non-native or alien as threatening. Now, that is not only individuals, it's not just people, it can also be ideas or even languages. So, for example, many nativist parties in Europe are very worried about Americanization, which they see as things like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, but also the use of English language. Right? So nativism is a bit broader than just being worried about individuals, but obviously immigration is at the heart of the issues for nativists. And the refugee crisis led to this belief that aliens were overrunning or swamping the country. Newspaper after newspaper would use these terms, feeding into it, and then you would have pictures as the one above, which are actually refugees walking from Budapest to Austria. And it also means the refugee crisis was meant as countries cannot protect its own borders. Right? What the refugee crisis showed was that we can't stop them, which is, of course, ultimately threatening for nativists who want to make sure that only those come in that they like. And then, absolutely crucial to any type of immigration debate in Europe, but also now the refugees, the majority of those that came were Muslim, or at least from Muslim-majority countries. And after 9/11, like the whole role of Islam and of Muslims in Western societies was already a hot debate. And so the refugee crisis triggered the nativism, but it also triggered the debate about immigration and about integration, both issues which are prime issues for the radical right. Now, authoritarianism doesn't mean an undemocratic idea. It more is the idea that the state should enforce order very strictly through law and order policies, tight policing, high sentences, as well as enforcement of discipline. Obviously, one of the key issues, political issues, that triggers authoritarianism is crime. And the refugee crisis was from the beginning linked to crime. On top of that, it links nativism and crime, right? Because it's crime by refugees, by foreigners. And the worst And that's always very good for newspapers as well as for triggering all kind of prejudices, is when you can link it to sexual crime. Right? And so in 2016, New Year's Eve, there was a big mass of people, mostly from North Africa, who were celebrating New Year's Eve in Cologne, one of the major cities in Germany, around the railway station. And there was a very high number of pickpocketing, but also sexual assaults, that led to these type of headlines, which obviously are also racist. But the Süddeutsche Zeitung is actually one of the best liberal newspapers, right? So if you get these type of headlines on those newspapers, you can only imagine what the tabloids will present. The refugee crisis also coincided with an increase in terrorism. Like 2015 started with the terrorist attack on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris. There was a massive attack in Brussels. There was, at the end, the massive attack in Paris. From the beginning, the two were linked. Not just by the media, actually individual politicians. On the night of the second terrorist attack in November, both the Prime Minister of Bavaria, the most powerful state of Germany, as well as the Foreign Minister of Poland, were already tweeting that this terrorist attack showed that we should close the border because refugees were terrorists. Right? Those are not even the radical right, the usual radical right ones. And so this whole discourse, right, of refugees and crime plays straight into the hands of the radical right. Now, the last point is populism. And populism is an idea that society is distinguished between two homogeneous and antagonistic groups. You have the pure people on the one hand and the corrupt elite on the other. And you believe that politics should follow what is called the general will of the people. So you think that policies can be made that benefit everyone in the same way. And you believe pretty much that the reason why we don't have these policies is because there is a corrupt elite on top that holds that back. Now, it's important that it's an elite, not elites. So the argument is that it doesn't matter whether it's Democrat or Republican, they're both corrupt. And although they say that they're different, they're really working together against the will of the people. Now, where populism was triggered was that the whole issue of nativism and authoritarianism, the refugee crisis was linked to borders. And within the European Union, there are no internal borders in the so-called Schengen zone. The argument, as a consequence, is as soon as someone is in Greece, or more specifically, in Hungary, they can be in Sweden, they can be in the Netherlands, right? And so that goes, first of all, to the nativism, like we can't protect our borders, but then the question is, why? And so everyone was angry at the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who was one of the few, and of course, one of the loudest voices for so-called Willkommenskultur, or welcome politics, a welcome culture. And she had said, all refugees are welcome. Now, many others said, well, that's fine that you think so, but if you make them welcome to Germany, they can go also to my country, and we might not actually want them. And so this interdependence of the European Union was really felt. The refugee crisis let that out. If the Dutch don't want to have refugees, but Germany does, it means that you have a large number of refugees at your border, which you actually can't protect anymore. I don't know whether the number has been named before, but roughly in 2015, 1.5 million refugees came in to Europe. About 850,000 came to Germany alone. Right? And so what Germany does is always very important. But if you have 850,000 refugees in Germany, all the countries around it are affected. Now, the argument of the radical right is the reason why we don't protect our borders is because we're all trying to please the EU. And our national politicians don't stand up for our country and our nation. Rather, they're chummy with their other elite friends in Europe, in Brussels, right, protecting their own kind of interests. So nativism, authoritarianism, populism were all triggered by the refugee crisis. Now, what is the political fallout of this all? There are three major consequences. First, there's been a surge in the popular support of far-right parties. Pretty much all of the parties that were already reasonably established would do better. Interestingly enough, the refugee crisis hasn't really created new parties. Most of the time, the parties that profited were either established radical right parties like Front National in France, FPÖ in Austria, or Party for Freedom in the Netherlands, who would go from what seemed to have been a ceiling of 15% shot up in the polls to 25, or Marine Le Pen, who went from 20 to 35 in the polls, now lower again. But also what it led to was a far-right turn of right-wing parties. Various parties that were kind of borderline radical right that would play a little bit with anti-immigration topics in elections, but it wasn't core to them, are now emphasizing it over and over again. UK Independence Party in Britain, for example, which used to be just a single issue party wanting to take the UK out of the EU, became a major voice against immigrants and against refugees. Alternative for Germany, similar story. First, more a Eurosceptic party, now a full-blown radical right party. But more importantly are the developments in Central and Eastern Europe, in particular, Viktor Orban. Now, Viktor Orban is the Prime Minister of Hungary, and he has a long career with many fundamental changes. Most importantly, he started out as a kind of libertarian anti-communist dissident. He was the darling of the West. Everyone liked him, got a scholarship from George Soros to go to Oxford, spoke English well. And so when he finally became prime minister at the end of the 1990s, he had moved a bit to the conservative side, but still everyone saw him as the hope, as the new generation of pro-Western, pro-democratic politicians. Once he lost power, didn't work very well. In 2010, he came back into power and transformed Hungary into an illiberal democracy, undermined independence of courts, attacked the media, etc., etc., had a new constitution that was deeply nationalist, authoritarian, but he didn't really say much about Europe. He was just busy with his own plan, and he would only lash out against Europe, the European Union, when they criticized him. With the refugee crisis, Orban became a European player. And so he has become the voice of opposition to immigration in general and against multiculturalism. He took on the welcome culture of Angela Merkel and challenged her really for dominance of the European idea. And he has been very successful because what he allowed others to do was actually torpedo Merkel's pro-immigration, but more specifically, pro-refugee plan without standing really in the spotlight. Right? And so the Dutch prime minister, for example, who always supports Merkel on everything, is in competition with the radical right party and so doesn't want to have too many refugees coming. But he can't really speak up about that and be the anti-refugee politician. But Orban can. And then Rutte can say, well, it seems that not everyone is on board with this, so perhaps we should wait. Right? And so Orban has been kind of the shield for more mainstream politicians to defend a much less pro-refugee and increasingly critical of multicultural policies. Now, the real question is this a shock or a transformation? So as I said, the refugee crisis created a perfect storm for the radical right because it brought to the fore their prime issues. Since the refugee crisis, we're not talking anymore about austerity politics. We're not talking anymore about how we can get European integration going again. We're talking about refugees. We're talking about Islam. We're talking about terrorism. We're talking about crime. All of those are the issues of the radical right. That's where they score on. Moreover, we do it within the frame of the radical right. You could talk about refugees in many different ways, but if we all talk about refugees as a potential threat, right, the radical right's already halfway. They don't set that agenda necessarily. Many are not that powerful. This is the frame that is often quite willingly adopted by mainstream media and then jumped on by mainstream politicians. The point is, if these are the major issues in the election, and someone who's really nativist and authoritarian is going to vote, they're not going to vote for the mainstream right party because they don't trust them to really do the job. They're going to go to the one that has always argued this, right? And so Jean-Marie Le Pen, who is the original leader of the Front National, who's now led by his daughter, already said in the 90s that voters prefer the original over the copy. And so when we speak about these issues, by and large, mainstream right-wing parties just help radical right parties win. And this is why the radicalization of right-wing parties is problematic, because first of all, it pushes policies to the right, pushes discourse to the right, and helps the radical right. What I think is important, though, is that the radicalization of right-wing parties since the refugee crisis is different than before. So obviously, when a new party comes up and has success, established parties are going to respond to that. And most of the time is what they do is that they will adopt some of the discourse. So when the Green parties became successful in the 1980s, everyone started to talk about the environment. We were all very concerned. But we were all very concerned, but we didn't do anything. Right? And that was the same mostly with immigration too and European integration. Everyone talked about it and multiculturalism. Angela Merkel, Nicolas Sarkozy, David Cameron, they all said that multiculturalism had failed. But they didn't really implement fundamentally different policies. The argument also was it had failed, but we should shape it differently. The goal was still the same, an open society with different people in it. Now, for the first time, we're really talking about, is multiculturalism good? Can Islam be integrated? And that this debate is not just from the radical right. That actually goes deep into the center-left. If you look at the Hollande government in France, for example, they speak about Islam more and more negatively. Social Democratic Party in Denmark has campaigned against immigration. So you see an enormous shift. What we saw also, and Trump played a major role in that as well, is we have now a kind of a dominant narrative that politics is all a struggle between the radical right and the status quo. We have various elections coming up in Europe in 2017. They're all framed in exactly the same way. They're all framed as an embattled status quo that is under threat from a resurgence of an incredibly popular radical right. Now, this is to a certain extent the case in the Dutch elections that are next month, where Geert Wilders is currently neck and neck with the prime minister being the most popular politician. Marine Le Pen is currently the most popular politician in France. But for example, in Germany, the radical right is only 10%. Angela Merkel, who allegedly is incredibly unpopular, if I read the newspapers correctly, is roughly as popular as she was 10 years ago. Now imagine that, a politician who's still equally popular as 10 years ago. Like, most political careers don't last longer than 4 or 5 years. Right? But it doesn't matter, because the frame that we talk about is that frame. And that frame helps the radical right, because it makes the radical right the most important challenger of the status quo. And it makes them a major player, even if they are necessarily not the case. AfD is the fifth biggest party in Germany, for example. But now we talk about the number one against the number five as if they're almost equally powerful. Now, I want to end on a happy note, even though that might be wishful thinking, and maybe I do this more for myself than for you. But I do believe that the success is fragile. Like, we have a narrative today that the populist radical right is really supported and that everyone really trusts them and believes that Trump is fantastic and Marine Le Pen can do everything. It's not. They're exactly the same as other politicians. If they don't deliver, they lose. One of the things in which there can be a Trump effect is not necessarily that it will help the radical right. It does for a while because we talk about the same issues as Trump talks about. But Trump is erratic. And Trump is relatively amateuristic. These are things that are problematic in the US, but they're far more problematic in much of Western Europe, where politics is seen as a craft, as something that you need to do, where people like stability. They don't like real shocks. And so one of the Trump effects could be actually a Trump boomerang. If Trump is perceived, as he is perceived now for the next weeks and months, as someone who just pretty much doesn't know what he's doing and messes up everything, people are going to think about whether it's such a good idea to bring in a new force of the radical right who shakes up things, because maybe they shake a bit too much. And so what I would think is that by September, we're talking about a very different narrative, a narrative about should we have someone who messes everything up or should we have someone competent who keeps it a bit going? Thank you very much.
We've just heard a presentation from the 2017 Camden Conference by Cass Mudde, an associate professor of public and international affairs at the University of Georgia and a researcher at the Center for Research on Extremism at the University of Oslo in Norway. You're listening to the second of a special series of programs focused on the theme of the 2017 Camden Conference, Refugees and Global Migration, Humanity's Crisis, here on Community Radio, WERU-FM. We turn now to a presentation by Timothy J. Kane entitled American Attitudes Toward Immigration. Mr. Kane is an economist and the J.P. Conte Fellow in Immigration Studies at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Timothy Kane.
Hello and good morning. Thanks, Gene, for the introduction. My name's Tim Kane. I'm an economist at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. I'm also a veteran Air Force officer, and I served overseas for about 3 years with our allies in South Korea and Japan. And I should warn you, I'm a relentless optimist. So even addressing this issue, I was motivated to go into the military and try to be active because thinking outside myself and seeing these images when I was a kid, it made me want to do something about it. I know that's what has brought us all together this morning. My optimism, it's driven me to study economics and try to understand why we live in this amazing time. And objectively, when we measure incomes around the world and how they're growing, there are countries that are failed states and that are dysfunctional. But the real story of our time is this amazing tidal wave of prosperity. And being stationed in South Korea gave me a sort of a front row seat, where in 1950, South Korea was poorer than North Korea. And believe me, North Korea wasn't anything special in 1950. It's still not. But now South Korea is one of the wealthiest economies in the world in raw numbers, but also in per capita terms. And we've seen that same story, this diffusion of growth, of economic growth and prosperity, that's just undeniable. It's happening in Latin America. It's happening, of course, across Europe, where we take it for granted. But if you went back and talked to development economists in the year 1950, and you asked them project into the future what countries, what regions would be sort of doomed to backwardness, and they would have said China and Southeast Asia, far behind Africa. And so that's really been the miracle in the world of economic growth, is how from Malaysia to Thailand to certainly mainland China itself, even Indonesia. I mean, you have to reach pretty far in Asia to find a country that's not experiencing this miraculous growth boom. And so that spreading, that gives me this optimism. Before I go any further in the speech, though, I did want to stop for a second and say thank you to the Camden Conference and the people of Camden. It's been, I mean, I've only been in Maine for 48 hours in my whole life. It's about the last 48 hours, and it's been been fabulous. I heard that Maine is the twin, long-lost twin of Michigan, where I grew up, and I feel very much at home here. So great to be here. Also, particularly Ward and Tracy Wickwire, who've been my hosts and have fed me really well. Actually, I had such a nice breakfast this morning, I kind of wanted to have nap time, but we're here. It's Sunday. Let's try to do the Lord's work. So yesterday, this idea of American exceptionalism came up, and I'm sure we'll get to that in Q&A, but I thought I'd go ahead and bring that into my talk a little bit. My faith in American exceptionalism is based in three things. And the first among those is that we are, in the United States, a nation of immigrants. That's why we're exceptional. There are a few other countries that are also nations of immigrants. I think Australia and Canada in particular, New Zealand, and there are others that I'm sure I couldn't list. But I think America's special because our immigrant roots are so diverse. They're not just deep. From every corner of the world, whether it's Asia or Latin America, certainly starting with the European migrants that came here. And so when we look abroad, unlike any other country, when we look in any direction in the world, we see family. When we see these images, that's family. So I think that drives us. The fact we've got a Statue of Liberty in the harbor of one of our greatest cities that says, huddled masses yearning to breathe free are welcome here. I still believe that. I think that's what we should aspire to. I'm not sure we always meet that. But that's what the first thing that makes me feel that this is an exceptional country. The second is, and maybe this will be controversial, I'm Catholic, so I believe there's evil and good, but there's evil in the world, and I think there's evil in this country, but I think fundamentally, America's a good country, and we don't want to forget that. I think that can be traced back to our founding documents, Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, documents that proclaimed a faith in universal values for all mankind. So when we engage the world, it's rarely in pursuit of what scholars would call national interest, selfish national interest. And again, my view of the world is formed in the cauldron of serving in the military and being stationed in South Korea. Harry Truman didn't send troops back to South Korea because they'd all been withdrawn after World War II to exploit the natural resources of South Korea. There aren't many. To, you know, steal the oil. It was for these universal values that liberty is something that's a universal good. And when we see others, whether it's in Kuwait or any country in the world oppressed, our heart goes out to them. And as I said, I think there's an aspect of seeing our brothers and sisters, not seeing strangers, not seeing aliens. In World War II, our soldiers didn't go to conquer and exploit or to hold land or to create the 51st state, rather to secure victories for allies and ultimately peace and prosperity for our foes as well. That had not been the norm for most of human history and how countries treated one another. And three, America's a democracy. Now, we're not the first. I'm not even sure we're the best. And we still have a lot to learn as Americans, but we're in pursuit of a more perfect union. And I think it's because the rights of the people to govern are by electing servants, not masters. Now, as an economist, I've spent a lot of years studying how nations grow, and I can tell you the American system of property rights, of contract law, of patents that are in the Constitution, that's the fundamental reason, that set of institutions, why we've grown so robustly for over 200 years, far surpassing the expectations of our European friends. And it's why we're still skyrocketing ahead with new technologies. And this idea of the images we saw in the beginning of the presentation today taken with an iPhone. I don't think the iPhone's existed for 7 years. Or, I mean, sorry, 10 years. This is, I believe, the 10th anniversary. And so by a company founded by a child of Syrian immigrants, by the way, Steve Jobs. So these are the reasons I'm optimistic, and I can't really repress that. And in particular, when we think about immigration, I think we should be proud of the special role that we have in the world today, a place that represents, for millions, a promised land to get to. I'm afraid we take this for granted, though, and that many in our country forget what has made us great. So let's remember that this year, there were 6 Nobel Prizes won by Americans, and all 6 were immigrants to the United States. In fact, 40% of the Nobel Prizes won by Americans are won by immigrants. And let's not forget that. Let's not forget that's what makes us great, what contributes to so much of our technological leadership that is then diffusing around the world. So I'm going to then turn to some slides and images. I had a fact sheet passed around that I hope some of you had a chance to look at, but I, being an economist, do try to focus on the facts. And so these are just some of the facts about immigration to remember. One of the most overwhelming is that the U.S. is the number one country in the world in terms of the raw numbers of immigrants welcome. I think that holds for refugees as well over the last 50 years, but certainly just in terms of immigrants. And in fact, that number's gone up in the past 20 years, whereas I think since the year 2000, we've welcomed an average of about 1 million legal residents per year, green card holders. And I will be exceptionally worried if that number goes down. Right now, it's that's through legislation, not through executive action. So if Congress debates this, I worry about our exceptionalism if I see Americans want to lower that or abandon that, respecting a democracy, but thinking that would be a bad decision. And then some of the other facts here that I think you've all had a few minutes to look at. I didn't want to read them all, but they're in the fact sheet, and they're online for those of us who aren't here to get the handout at hoover.org. Look under immigration, and we try to make that prominent. So let's look again at facts, this time turning our attention to refugees. So I was interested about these the executive actions that were taken by the president and the restriction on all refugees, or I should say a hold, but a potential ban on these seven countries in particular. And I was curious how those seven fit in to the overall portfolio of where refugees are coming from. So I highlighted a few of those in colors, but for most of the countries where we've been accepting refugees, and this is for the last 10 years, by country of nationality, are not from those seven countries. In fact, Cuba is where the president, President Obama, I should say, this is really Obama's agenda, right, where he made his priorities. Roughly 100,000 a year refugees came in, so overall it's about 1 million. Cuba, number one, Burma, number two, Iraq, number three, Bhutan, number four. Now, I have to apologize. If anybody doesn't know where Bhutan is, I've written a book about countries in the world where I categorized each country's economic freedom, and I wasn't sure where Bhutan was. So I do know now, and it's a great story. President Obama wanted to make sure there was a refugee camp of Bhutanese Hindus who had fled the country, and they had been in refugee camps for a while, and he wanted to be part of the solution. The United States took a leadership role, taking more of refugees out of that camp than any other country, more than India, more than Nepal, 100 times more than China, for example, right, by a factor of two orders of magnitude. That's global leadership, and I think that's something to be proud of. But the question is, imagine you're the president. You have 50,000 refugees that have been traditionally welcomed to the United States every year. Sometimes that can be raised. President Obama, at the end of his term, raised it to about 110,000. But you have to set priorities. It's not a question of being open to the whole world. It's a question of where do you set your priorities. Venezuela is not one of the top countries here. I think maybe if I were president, I would want to welcome refugees from Venezuela, which is going through a pretty horrible crisis, self-imposed by a communist dictatorship. These are President Obama's priorities, and I don't think they're wrong. President Trump will have different priorities. What I hope he doesn't do is lower the numbers. I think 100,000 is a good number. I would personally like to see us welcome 150,000, but recognize there's a capacity constraint to democratic attitudes. But that's really an interesting question, and I'm not sure where you all would prioritize, but that really is the fundamental question. It's not do you care or don't you care? It's where do you think you can do the most good, and how can you do the most good? Because welcoming refugees is only one part of the engagement solution. I mean, if we want to put our heads in the sand, we can do none of this. But refugee policy is one aspect. Certainly in a country as powerful as America, there are other aspects, and there are longer-term horizon thinking that we should do. So the second point here is these are the seven banned nations, just based on President Obama's last year that we have on record, at least where we have good data. And the seven countries, if you pull them out, are minuscule in terms of those being a priority for the president. I think it was 2 years ago, the number of refugees from Syria that the Obama administration was welcoming was 34. And the year before that, it was like 25. So this wasn't a high priority for him, going back to 2011 when the crisis started and was raging. So Now maybe it should be a priority, I don't know, but for a lot of years, it wasn't. This isn't just about Republican, Democrat. Cuba, we've always had a long-standing policy, and I think it's been a good policy to welcome refugees from Cuba. Okay, now this notion of the numbers, I think the numbers we have that we've heard a couple times, 21.3 million refugees worldwide, and as Alexandra pointed out yesterday, we need to remember the internally displaced, 65.3 million, most recent data. But I think sometimes that data missed some people. I haven't dug into it. Alexander maybe can tell us more details, or Kelly. But 1974, these are Cambodian children who were soon killed after this photo was taken by the Khmer Rouge. I don't know if they were counted as refugees or internally displaced. But it's been a bad world in a lot of places with a lot of evil for a long time, including this data set that covers, you know, this is the worst crisis ever. I'm not sure it's the worst today that it's ever been. This is a concentration camp in Europe, and we shall never forget Bosniaks, and that crisis was happening from 92 to 95. And in both of these places, I think maybe the U.S. was either slow or negligent in being more engaged. We could put up photos of Rwanda as well. Great shame is that we didn't get involved in Rwanda. And then these are Cuban refugees, 2016, still happening, thousands and thousands fleeing a repressive communist country. There's a paradox here, though, that I want to talk about, which is let's think about conflict in the world and how bad things are today versus how bad they have been historically. There's an international data set that counts battle deaths, which correlates with a lot of other violence, and these are some of the data on that. Steven Pinker, a professor associated with Harvard University, wrote a great book called The Better Angels of Our Nature and looked at violence around the world. In fact, this violence has been coming down dramatically. About 300 deaths per 100,000 people were happening during the Second World War. That number's dropped dramatically, about 22 during the Korean War. This is a global number, so you could have a very small country with much higher numbers than that. But globally, this number's been coming down, down, down to where it was 1.4 in the year 2014. That's unambiguously great news, that there's less violence. And this goes across the board from murders domestically, and this happens in country after country. Now, we tend to focus in this culture of ours on what CNN tells us. And CNN gets our attention with fighting and conflict and blood. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. And so we get mesmerized into thinking we live in a horrible world. And we live in a world where good people have made the world a better place. We have more honest people keeping the police less corrupt, not just in the U.S., but globally. We have international agencies like Transparency International that are focusing on which countries are corrupt and putting a spotlight on those that are still terribly corrupt and trying to help them improve. This is the a data set that comes from Max Roser based on this battle death data. And it traces back to the year 1400. I know it's hard to read, but you can see the bright red line. With a logarithmic scale of deaths per 100,000 people, over time, since the year about 1400, and the size of these circles represent how many people overall were killed. So it's relative to population in the line. But you can see the Second World War and the First World War up in the top right had huge numbers of people killed. The genocide of the Jews, the Armenian genocide. A separate data set goes from the year 1946 to 2013, and there's just been an absolute collapse. Again, a logarithmic scale to where the numbers globally are 0.5, and they've gone back up to 1.4. But I like to celebrate this, and I think America is one of the countries that can take credit for not having World War III and making sure the Cold War never became a hot war and trying to work with allied countries around the world to create a more peaceful and a more prosperous world, to support things like a global trade agreements, and get people to focus their energies not on destruction but on construction. So I'm optimistic, but then that leaves us with a bit of a paradox. Why is the number of global refugees rising when global violence is declining? And this is where, Kelly, when you had that slide, looking at how these networks of refugees are thickening, even though the origin countries, really not much has changed. Because we live in a world of revolutionizing transportation networks, right? Flights are cheaper. There are more and more cars and vehicles. And so it's easier now for people to be mobile, which is, I think, the most fundamental human right, that when people are in a bad situation and they can improve their lives, whether it's violence, whether it's drought, They now have the capacity and the means to do so. Again, that's good news, but we've got this paradox of one trend going down, fewer and fewer violent deaths, but more and more refugees. And then how do we reconcile that as a world together? I want to ask you all a question. So I promised to talk about American attitudes about immigration, and I do want to focus on that with my remaining time. So let me ask you this question, which has been asked for many, many years by Pew. Do you think having an increasing number of people of many different races, ethnic groups, and nationalities in our country makes it a better place to live, a worse place to live, or no difference? And I want you to think, what would you imagine is the typical American response today to that? What percentage of people would say it's a better place to live or a worse place to live? So I was kind of pessimistic about this. I've been studying immigration for a while. And these are the numbers, but not just that we're asked in the United States, that were asked across the world in a number of European countries, where here we have a perception that we're mean-spirited, we're not as welcoming, and we need to be, you know, more like other countries which are around the globe. But it turns out America is actually amazingly open and welcoming and thinks that having people of many different races and backgrounds makes our country stronger. And it doesn't just say having them. It says, do you think having an increasing number will make the United States stronger, a better place to live? Now, the next most welcoming country is Sweden, with 36%, compared to our 58% who answer positively. But it's almost half. Britain, Spain, France, Germany, Italy. Italy, it's 18%, about a third of the percent, third of the number of people that are welcoming to an increasing number. Greece, it's 10%. And just look at the place, the number of people who said 7% said it's a worse place to live. That's an amazingly small number, given what you've been told are the Americans' attitudes toward the world. This is why America's more welcoming and the number one country in terms of welcoming immigrants. And I do literally pray that we maintain that attitude. Now, the other attitude that Americans have that I wanted to share with you is, here's a headline from another study. I think this is from Pew as well. The headline is, Americans' view of immigration is marked by widening partisan divide, right? But dig into the details and you can see the number here. Okay, this is the top question was views of immigrants' impact on the U.S. and the number who say, this is overall, not partisan, that they're a burden by taking jobs, housing, and health care. In 1994, that was 63% of Americans thought that. Today, the number is 33. We cut in half. Now look at this widening partisan divide, right? So we're all split and we're all angry at each other. Sure, the Democratic number went from 32% who say they strengthen our country up to 78. That's great. The Republican number went from 30%, and you'd think it went down. That's what a widening divide means. No, Republican average went from 30% to 35%. So even Republicans are more welcoming to immigrants. And again, I think that's good news. So now maybe it's those crazy independents. They don't show the independents number up here, but the independents are going up too. So that's not your escape hatch. All right, you saw this, you saw this. Now, here's one that we deal with most of all is, what do we do about the 11 million illegal immigrants here? We've been talking about 11 million illegal immigrants for about 15 years because the number hasn't changed that much. How do you deal with them? And the media will tell you, let's fight about it. And the politicians would like us to fight about this as if it was a black and white issue, binary issue, two answers. You either deport them all or you give them a pathway to citizenship, which to a lot of Americans, Republican and Democrat, think is amnesty. I've been arguing for a long time. Isn't there a middle road here? Can you not deport everyone and not give them free citizenship, but give them a legal status so they can be mobile, they can come out of the shadows? And it turns out I'm not alone. A majority of Democrats do not support the idea of free citizenship to people who've broken the law coming here. A majority of Republicans, the red numbers here, do not support forced deportation. The consensus opinion is so clear. Certainly if you look at the independents, right, in the gray, the largest number of people where you can find a compromise is to grant legal status. And why Congress won't offer that, I think, tells us a lot more about politicians than it does about the American people. That's the solution. And maybe a president will come along who will support that. Unfortunately, we've had presidents in the past and political leaders in the past who wouldn't go to this compromise. They wanted a big comprehensive bill, which means let's keep fighting and not pass anything. I don't have enough time to get too much further into it without coming to my concluding comments. But the American people have good common sense on this issue. And I think if we could get Congress to be responsive to what the people want, instead of just focusing on re-election, we could solve this one pretty easily. So this is lastly, I started to take a survey of scholars on immigration, left, right, and center, and ask them which particular individual ideas do they think are good. One of the questions we asked in our survey was, should we increase U.S. refugee limits? I was really happy to see about 85% said yes. They either agree or strongly agree with that. I asked them about open borders. There wasn't consensus. A majority of people were opposed to open borders. So even among experts, there's a lot of consensus going forward, and I would point you all to that. I've got 30 seconds left. I wanted to point to this reality, though. This is what a lot of people see when they think about immigrants and refugees in the Middle East. They see ISIS. It's a real concern. And even if we increase the number of refugees coming, under President Obama, the number of Syrian refugees that were welcomed to the United States was 0.15%. And we can double that, and we can feel better. Or we can be sanctimonious and say, oh, this is terrible, it's not higher. But sanctimony is not policy. And I'll warn you, democracy's also not the problem. When you see democratic people worried about terrorism, it's legitimate. You know, what's happened in Boston, what's happened in Paris. Those are legitimate fears. But my issue is, I really care about all those people that are refugees that can't get to a country to find refuge. So do we engage in Syria? Do we send U.S. troops unilaterally? I'd be in favor of doing whatever it takes to alleviate the root problem. And I think that means it's got to be a lot more than just feeling bad that we don't accept more refugees into our country. So what should we do? Three things. One, stay engaged. From free trade to staying welcome to immigration to maintaining alliances around the world, particularly in the Middle East. Stay open to the world. And then three, lead the world. Sometimes we can do a lot of multilateral action. I'm not against it. But there are times when multilateral action means you keep having conference after conference after conference while the Bosniaks are being killed and put in concentration camps. So sometimes this is our time in history where the U.S., for whatever reason, is the strongest country in the world. And I think that gives us an obligation. So thank you all. Looking forward to Q&A.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.
That was Timothy Kane, J.P. Conte Fellow in Immigration Studies at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, in a presentation entitled American Attitudes Toward Immigration. This is the second program in our series of selections from the 2017 Camden Conference here on Community Radio WERU-FM. Our final program will be tomorrow, Friday, March 31st. We'll conclude the series with a live call-in program at 10 a.m. We'll be joined in the studio by Jean Bergot of Internews, who served as this year's conference moderator, and Ray Jennings, currently a principal of the Cultural Navigation Group. For more information on the Camden Conference, go to www.camdenconference.org. If you'd like to listen to this program again or to suggest it to a friend, go to www.weru.org, where you'll find all the programs in the series in the Public Affairs Archive. Thanks for listening, and please join us for the other programs in this series of selections from the 2017 Camden Conference.